I'm Al McFarland. Welcome to The Conversation with Al McFarland. I'm glad to be here and glad to have you along as well. It's Thanksgiving week, and I think we all have things to be thankful for. I think a lot of us are anxious about the way of the economy and all of the news in the country. But beneath that, we are all grateful for the ability to sort of unplug and sit back and assess and value the loved ones in our lives, the successes we've had, and the visions we have for building with healing and wholeness for ourselves, our families, and our community. Well, today's program, as always, is what I call one that's chock full of robust conversation. We've got great guests today. And before I do bring them in, I want to remind you and thank you for listening to the show here on KFAI and those who are checking us out through any of the social media platforms. We're streaming live to LinkedIn. We're streaming live to two YouTube channels, that for Black Press of America, Black Press USA, and our Insight News channel. And we're streaming live to X and Facebook as well. No matter where you're connecting, we want you to feel and know that that connection's important and powerful. If you want to comment on today's show or other topics, just drop a note in the chat and those will show up and we can respond and shout you out. Tell us where you're listening from. And as always, we invite you to subscribe and join by going to the Insight News YouTube page and becoming a subscriber. Help us grow our community. Well, I want to begin today by introducing my first guest. And it's a gentleman that I've interviewed before. I've been totally First Independence and CEO. First Independence Bank, as you recall, is a Detroit-based financial institution that in the past couple of years, 3 years maybe, opened branches here in Twin Cities, Minnesota. And what a wonderful thing to see this bank established as a Black-owned business, establish a presence in the Twin Cities, and to do that in a way that was collaborative of all the other banking institutions in the Twin Cities. So it's really a good story. Well, now Chairman Kelly, as he's called, has been named the 2025 chair of the American Bankers Association. So we're pleased to have him on today to talk about his recent achievements, his professional journey. You know, we want to learn about what and who is and what is the American Bankers Association, and you know, what kind of leadership insights, trends and challenges in the industry, visions for his future and his tenure, his thoughts about community involvement and the impacts of recent developments in the financial sector on consumers. So Chairman, good afternoon. Welcome to the conversation with Al McFarland. How you doing?
Hey, Al, great. Great to be with you and great to see you again. Thanks for having me.
Likewise, great to see you. Let's do a one-on-one. I want to just appreciate the importance of First Independence Bank for those of us here in Minnesota. But tell the story about how you came to establish branches here in Minnesota and give the background on First Independence Bank.
Sure, certainly, Al. Well, I will tell you, it's an honor to be here with you. Let me say a couple of things before I get into that aspect of the story, Al. As you just mentioned, I'm currently the chair of the American Bankers Association. It's the largest banking association of financial institutions in the country. And so we are very grateful to be sitting in this seat, but it's also directly related to having community advocates like you, Al, and being sure that when we move to a new community like we did into Minneapolis, that we are supported by leadership and people see us as really a conduit to the communities. And so I just want to say thank you for what you do and how you've done that. You know, at First Independence Bank, our mission has always been clear to be a trusted partner to the communities. We came with that in mind 3 years ago when we, 3.5 years ago, technically, when we moved into the Minneapolis market after the murder of George Floyd. And I will tell you, I think all of us can agree, banking is ultimately about trust and relationships. And that has been really a gap that we have seen in communities of color, specifically communities of African-American ethnicity. And so our bank, which started now 55 years ago in Detroit, was created in that premise of being that connective tissue of creating financial trust in a community of color in the midst of the 1967 Detroit riots. So our footing, our grounding has been instrumental into us being successful over the last 55 years. And it was very consistent when the five major banks there in the Minneapolis market asked us to consider moving into Minneapolis. Our founding was very consistent. It was police brutality that led us to our founding in Detroit. Similarly, after George Floyd's murder, it was those five banks who saw us as a needed instrument in the Minneapolis market. And Al, you have been one of those great advocates of ours, and I'm so grateful to have you as one of our advocates there in that marketplace. So again, thank you for having us today.
Well, thank you again for being here. And to our listeners, if you have a question or comment of Chairman Kelly, I'd love to have your comment, just whichever social media platform you're on. Drop a note in the comment section and we'll try to bring that question forward. And so your background, your own personal background, you came into the bank. I think you were in the accounting business. Am I correct or not?
Well, no, a little bit further right or left, depending on how you consider your use of your brain. I'm an engineer by training, Al, and spent really most of my career inside of an electric utility, Southern Company, which was based in Atlanta, and really had a wonderful career there, Al. I had a chance to work across many aspects of the company. I started out in engineering, as we talked about, did industrial marketing, working with large customers, doing power contracts, ended up moving into corporate finance. The company loaned me to the University of Alabama, where I ended up getting my MBA. And then I moved into a host of other areas, human resources, supply chain management, ended up in the sales teams. And the latter part of my career was actually in the unregulated aspect of the business. And I was negotiating and buying solar projects predominantly in California and in the state of Texas on behalf of Southern Company. So I had a pretty broad career. And to your point of getting into banking, a cousin of mine actually bought this bank 45 years ago, and unfortunately, we lost him in 2014, where he ran the bank successfully for 34 years. And I was asked to come in and sit and listen and participate. And at the time, the interim chairman said, "You need to be sitting in this seat," based on the questions that we were asking. And so that's a long story to how we got here today. And we've gotten in being serious about communities and how to serve. And that led us to leadership in the National Bankers Association and ultimately into the American Bankers Association.
There's a connection between your bank and the music industry in Detroit. What's that connection?
Yeah, so my cousin Don Davis actually was a music producer. He produced everything that, if anyone knows the name Johnny Taylor, he produced all of Johnny Taylor's. He also produced of Johnny Taylor the first platinum album, which was Disco Lady in 1976. And then the one that many people recognize and know was Marilyn Davis and Marilyn McCoo and Billy Davis Jr. "You Don't Have to Be a Star to Be in My Show." He produced that song for them. And so he was really a producer, a studio owner. After Berry Gordy left and went to California, he had the studio where Aretha Franklin and so many others, Anita Baker, recorded there in Detroit. And in the 80s, he decided that, you know, he says the farthest he's ever traveled was from the music business to the banking business when he bought this bank in 1980. So that correlation is certainly there. And, you know, he spent time down also in Memphis. Many people probably remember the label, if you're of a certain age, Stax. And so he was involved with Stax and Isaac Hayes and Al Bell and so many others who were involved in the Stax Renaissance there in Memphis, Tennessee. And so, as you know, Minneapolis has a very strong, you don't even have to say Minneapolis all the way to the end and know that the music legends and the history there associated with Minneapolis. So there's a little bit of a correlation there in association with our music background.
Speaking of which, this is a wonderful sort of aside for our listeners here in Twin Cities. The city has experienced the transformation of one of its music icons. Gary Jellybean Johnson was the bass player and drummer with The Time and was part of the whole Prince movement, the Minneapolis Sound. He departed, and we've got a story on him in today's Insight News, and we'll be doing more. But thank you for making reference to the centrality of music in the life of people in Minneapolis and St. Paul, Minnesota. I'm Al McFarland. This is The Conversation with Al McFarland. I'm talking with Chairman Kenneth Kelly. He's the chairman and CEO of First Independence Bank, based in Detroit, which is here in Minnesota, recently named chair of American Bankers Association. Chairman Kelly, so take a minute. You mentioned that the American Bankers Association is one of the nation's largest financial services industry organizations. Tell me more about it. What does ABA do? What is it and what does it do?
Yeah, so let's go back to the beginning. So the ABA is actually celebrating its 150th anniversary. I don't think I have to get into details to really elaborate on what timing that was. But the reality is there were some bankers who understood that the women's suffrage movement was actually getting traction and getting people to recognize the ideal of commonality and coming together and identifying things that you need to really work on and having and creating a voice for that. And so those bankers from about 35 states, met in Saratoga Springs, New York in 1875 to decide and create the American Bankers Association as an opportunity to be the voice of banking regarding banking issues. Now, the times were extremely difficult, but I would tell you at the end of the day, that has turned into what is now the most successful voice of banking across this country. Our organization has been in existence, as I said, 150 years. What we are working on right now is what I call the three strategic pillars. One is being a unifying advocate for banking, which goes back to the start I just mentioned to you. But secondly, to be an innovative catalyst, being sure that we are staying up on the times as it relates to what's going on with technology and how banking is impacted by that. And then lastly, I would tell you, most importantly, is being a trusted partner. You heard me make reference to that in First Independence and how we operate within the communities that we serve. But that is also true about the ABA and what we're trying to accomplish on behalf of all banks. There are roughly 4,500 banks in the country, Al. And as you know, when you think about that, you know, that impacts basically all of our communities in some form or fashion. What we are seeing is really kind of an aggregation of banks because the cost of banking has been very challenging. And so institutions like ours focus on not only the broader issues that you see out in public, but also the finer issues to be sure that banks can operate and compete fairly in the marketplace. As I've said before, if it looks like a bank and acts like a bank, it should be treated as a bank. And so we're seeing many, I would say, non-bank type entities move into the financial space. And unfortunately, it has been taking away from the opportunities of why banks are in the communities that they serve and what they're trying to do with those communities and serving those customers and being sure that they can reach their economic empowerment, having, as I use the term, oxygen in those communities. And so that's really the essence of the ABA, what we do on a daily basis. Entails everything from being sure that individuals on the Hill, whether that is in Congress, legislative, also executive branch, in addition to the regulatory environment, understand the issues that are important to banks and weighing in on those in such a way that that's a positive outcome on behalf of banks.
Well, let me ask you personally how you navigated to that position of leadership in ABA. I'm sure you have to think long and deep before presenting yourself as a contender, or maybe you were invited to that position. But give me the story of how you found your way to that seat of leadership.
Al, it's pretty incredible to be candid with you to sit in this seat and, as you said, navigate to this seat. But I've always just had a servant's heart, just go to serve. And I was the chair of the National Bankers Association. And at the time, it's
even explain in the that for listeners. Our audience
that's a very, very good point, Al. You're so good at your role. You're helping me to peel back the onion a little bit here, probably more than I would have normally. So the National Bankers Association actually represents the minority banks in this country. It was founded in 1927. So we're 2 years from being 100 years old. where at that time, actually, it was just black banks, really modeled after what I described to you regarding the ABA some 52 years later. And so black banks created an association, and then it morphed into now all minority banks. But
let me make an aside here just so people have a framework for this, what you're describing. So like NBA, National Banker or National Banker Association,
yes,
is what it's called,
and that's ABA, correct.
In the law, there's American Bar Association and the National Bar. One is black, right? In the health field, there is the American Medical Association and the, I think it's called the Black Medical Association or some name like that. But what I'm pointing out is parallel structures. And part of the story underneath the story is we as a community, as a culture, have created systems that allow us to enjoy the benefits of order and organization and movement and collective growth, even in places where our presence leadership were resisted and in fact rejected. And what we have done as a culture and community is play the long game, and we keep winning. And I think your leadership is a signal and a sign of that ongoing commitment to lead by service. Is that a fair statement?
No, that's spot on, right on target. As you know, even as we think about education, there, you know, the university I went to, my parents couldn't go to, nor could my grandparents. And so you're exactly right. There was a parallel structure there. But to your point, service has been, if you think about Dr. King, service has been really leadership through service has been an avenue to really get to that more perfect union, is the way that I would describe it. And so to your point, let me go back to the story you'd ask about, which was I was a chair of the National Bankers Association. And at the time, we were working on some things together with the American Bankers Association. In fact, we ended up striking a deal and writing together an MOU, a memorandum of understanding, where it was really beneficial to both organizations, but certainly probably more so to the National Bankers Association. From that, my leadership was seen worthy enough to be asked to join the board of the American Bankers Association. And at the time, I was the only African-American on the board and served and really came to really having a very great relationship with a mentor who ended up becoming the chair of the association. And he took me on the road with him to a couple of different events, not anything express. It just kind of happened. And long story short, it wasn't long after that, you know, my discussion as being a contender for becoming the chair of the board really kind of got set in place and put in motion and went through, as you can imagine, the competitive process of being selected and or chosen to serve in this role. And so we're very grateful for that. But to your point of the story, you know, no one person can make those decisions by themselves. You have to build alliances in places, and sometimes they're in places where you don't expect them to come from, but that allows you to be successful in trying to achieve your goal. But I've always approached it with just being of service first and let the chips kind of fall where they may. But it's a great question, Al.
Well, so let me ask you, Chairman Kelly, about the political, not political so much, but the financial landscape, the economic landscape, as you're leading from the vantage point of a chair of ABA. What things as a country are we paying attention to for economic stability and growth? What's your thought?
Well, Al, as you know, you don't have to go far to see the data to see that there are disparities. The wealth gap is a real issue. It is something that I think about. In fact, I ended up writing a book on the topic because I got asked about the topic of the wealth gap as a CEO and chairman of a bank. And I think you and I may have shared a story. That's a whole nother show we could talk about. But at the end of the day, I would tell you from my perspective in the seat that I sit in now, it is about economics, understanding that banks are really the vital part of being sure that there's oxygen in all communities, not just some communities. And so our goal is to be sure that banks are as strong as they can be, so that they can serve those communities they care about. I would say ancillary of that is being sure that minority banks and CDFIs, community development financial institutions, which typically serve low and moderate incomes, are as strong as they can be. That was the reason we approached the ABA in the beginning to set up a memorandum of understanding. And so I say that to say our presence, our intent in being at the table is to ensure that those voices are heard that may not have been previously regarding low and moderate income communities, which, you know, disproportionately impact people of color across this country. And so that level of, I would tell you, perspective being at the table is something that we certainly bring in our seat as we plan to serve going forward. But if you go back to our institution and its founding, its original intent was to serve a local minority / low-income community, our First Independence Bank. But I would tell you one of the outcomes of that I think that's worth importance to share with your audience is one of the original founders of the bank, who actually passed in 2020, shared with me in January of 2020. He said the beauty of us starting this bank in 1970 was that at the major banks, African-Americans started to get other jobs besides being a janitor and a teller. He said the opening of First Independence Bank had an impact on the rest of the banking community in Detroit by ensuring that African-Americans started to get other jobs, such as working as analysts and lending, et cetera. And so I say that to say, you know, oftentimes there's not a direct correlation between where something is and where things are being impacted. And I would say the same is true as it relates to me having the opportunity to sit in this seat. There's probably not going to be a direct impact of, well, Kenneth Kelly was the chair today, so this happened tomorrow. But it will be the gradual movement, back to your point of getting to a more perfect union, of being in this seat creates perspectives that may be different going forward. And so that's the intent and the reason that we bring our perspective to the table and the intent of serving in this role.
Well, Chairman Kelly, you know, as a communicator, I'm a scribe, a journalist, right, a documenter, and I want to sort of restate and reemphasize what you just said, because it's so important. And I think that the fact that you're in that seat, it's like you're an explorer and you have discovered new territory and new terrain. And the beauty of it is that when our people find opportunities to do things, to do, you know, different things in different places that are consistent with the professional and the service mission of business itself, it loosens the ground and allows more of us to grow into opportunity. And as we grow into opportunity, we know that not only do we help our community, but we help the entire country. And I would dare say the entire, you know, family of humanity, because we're opening up and allowing, as you described it, new oxygen to be manufactured and shared in the service of all of our humanity. Does that make sense to you as an observation?
Well, you are living in your gift. You said it well and succinctly. And I just can't emphasize that more. You said it well and very succinctly.
So, you know, technology, what technology advances are happening in the industry, and how does that technology impact our community or the consumer, not just our community, but our community is part of the consumer base?
Yeah, I would tell you, as you can imagine, Al, that as you think about it, you know, I saw a study the other day that shows that individuals don't read books at the same level they used to. You know, our minds have been really retrained for the snap it, the quick hit, the TikTok, the Facebook, et cetera. And technology is providing kind of that change or that morphing. And the same is true as it relates to money. And we have to stay, I will tell you, on the cutting edge and or become fast followers as we look at how technology is changing. We're hearing terms that for many people, they may not even understand, but we need to learn those terms. AI, you're hearing terms stablecoin, you're hearing terms Bitcoin. What do those things mean? I will say that all of us need to accept the challenge that we're going to have to stay on the ready, have to stay willing to learn and to understand what's going on around us, or we'll be left behind. For us, technology.
Let me jump in and say that I'm one of those who doesn't understand what Bitcoin is. So I'm going to take the liberty, since I have the banker on the phone, explain to me what Bitcoin is and how it works.
Well, I would tell you, because I don't want to get into prescribing things, the best way I could say it is that, you know, it's an exchange. And it's an exchange not any different than way people think about stocks or commodities, et cetera. And the intent is you hope if you buy into that exchange, it will go up just like you would with a stock or any other commodity. But the reality is it is not based on what we would typically say are hard financial numbers that you can look at and study and say there's causality based on what I see in front of me that will lead it to a gain in the future. And so from that perspective, I think it creates risk for many individuals because they hear about it and think they need to do it, but don't understand it. If you go back to Warren Buffett, one of the things he's always stated about the companies that he has bought is that he understands those companies. So my point is, even in the stock market, there are companies that you can understand and there are companies you can't understand. And so my point is, I want to make a corollary that even when you get into Bitcoin, it has less of that understanding in terms of financials that really undergird it. And so unfortunately, what we're starting to see is a little bit of a retraction in that marketplace. And again, I don't want to forecast, but I'm trying to paint a picture from a theory perspective of what we see with that, with Bitcoin relative to stocks and or relative to commodities. But my point is, I think you need to understand it, even if you don't participate in it, so you know that you're making a good decision. And that is also true about stocks. But going back to Warren Buffett and how he talks about stocks is he buys things that he understands, Coca-Cola, McDonald's, pizza, shoes, things that he knows that people are going to buy because they need them and or they like them. And I think the same is true for all of our financial decisions. They should be based on our engagement with those organizations in a way that we understand them. And so my point to you or to the audience would be, I wouldn't buy anything I don't understand, but that doesn't mean I don't want to learn about it. And I'm going to leave it at that. I won't go any further than that because I don't want to come across as trying to sway someone to do a, make a decision that they shouldn't be or should be making in that regard. But my point is, at the end of the day, technology is moving at such a pace that if you put your head in the sand, you will get left behind intentionally or unintentionally. Inside of First Independence, I'll tell you, we're trying to tackle that even as part of an institution and how we engage with our customers. Our intent is to keep our customers at the center of the circle of life. But when our customers want immediate demands, we want to be able to respond immediately or as fast as we can. And my point is, technology is driving that change, not only inside of our bank, but really across banking, because customers now have a different demand regarding how they want to be served going forward. And so our focus has become really, how do we ensure that we are meeting the customers where they want to be met as it relates to technology?
Listen, we're almost at the close of this part of the interview. I wanted to ask if there's any special advice or directions that you would leave for our listeners and viewers about the general economic environment. I think that I mentioned at the beginning, there's a certain amount of uncertainty right now. And you know, I don't want to ask you to be a crystal ball gazer, but what practical things can ordinary people do to make sure that they are on top of, you know, their life, even in moments of uncertainty? What do you think?
Yeah, I would tell you these are going to be very basic principles. Be sure that your income is greater than your outcome, if you had to say it, or in the way that my friend John Hope Bryant would say it, you don't want to have too much end of the month at the end of your money, so to speak. And those are very basic principles. And I know it sounds kind of coy and maybe even corny for some. But at the end of the day, the gesture that I'm making is manage what you can control. Don't try to manage things that we don't control. I will tell you, to your point, there is quite a bit amount of uncertainty. And guess what? We're going to have to learn to live with that. And it appears to be that that's going to be the case for a period of time. So the way that we're going to manage that is try to maintain what's going on in our sphere of influence, in our circle of influence, the best we can in the environment. Doesn't mean we're not trying to look around the corner and understand what may be coming or what has been lost. But at the end of the day, let's just try to focus on what we can control inside of our circle of influence. And that will be my advice to your audience, knowing that they are as savvy as they are.
Well, listen, thank you so much for this time to visit with you. We'll do it again in the future. Let me ask you to hang out. Got more guests here. Introduced you to them before the show, but to the degree that you're able to spend some more time with us, please do.
I'd love to bring you in. Thank you.
Todd Western III and Marcus Carpenter, you guys coming in. Todd is the co-founder of the Iowa Farmers of Cover, and Marcus Carpenter is the founder of Route One. Todd, Marcus, guys, welcome to the conversation with Al McFarland. I am fascinated with the idea of meeting a brother that's a farmer is just like meeting a brother that's the president of a bank. It's a wonderful thing. So I was glad to meet you and to learn, Todd, about you and your family being farmers and that you're working now to collectively advance, you know, your family and sector of business. Todd, welcome. Talk about the Iowa Farmers of Cover, first of all, and you can introduce Marcus and tell me how you guys are working together to bring better outcomes for your industry.
Thank you so much. I appreciate it. Thank you so much. Don't so much.
You told me that you were at Minneapolis when First Independence. Tell that story.
So in addition to farming and the 18 other jobs I have, I also have a rental business where I had some rental houses. And so what I would do is when First Independence first came to Minneapolis, what I did was I funneled all of our business from the rental business to First Independence when they first opened up. So I was there on the first day with the balloons and the cake and ice cream, all good stuff. And so we put all our money in from that particular business in the First Independence Bank. And like with any business, you have issues, startup issues, whatever. And so they were just figuring their way out. And so, like I said, I've been with since day one, and we had a little customer service issue. And my good buddy Damon Jenkins,
president of the bank.
So what happened was I was dealing with the teller and some other people, and we just couldn't figure out certain things with my accounting stuff. And then he had heard the conversation, and he came out from around the corner, and he said, "I got it. Let me work with him, because obviously he's been dealing with this for a minute. Let me deal with him." So I was really impressed with, he's the big shot, right? So he came from behind the desk and walked me through my issue, and I'm still with them, and my issue was resolved right there on the spot. So customer service is key for me, because I was born in 1966. So all I know is customer service, right? So you can have all the titles you want to until you don't need to have, and you need to get down, pull the sleeves up and help people. And so that's why I'm really impressed with First Independence Bank.
That's great. Chairman Kelly, what's a customer like Todd Western mean for your bank and for bank?
Well, it's the essence of what we, subscribe and try to do and provide every day. We talk about it, the customers at the center of the circle of life. That is not just a slogan. It is really a business strategy for us. And to hear Todd describe how he was taken care of by Damon Jenkins, our leader there in the Minneapolis market, I mean, to be candid, it's fulfilling to my heart, because that's our mission every day, to make life easier for entrepreneurs, be sure that they can take care and provide for their families, and hopefully create a resource so that we could always be there to be of service.
That's awesome. Todd, go ahead. Thank you for that. Talk about your farming story.
I'm a sixth generation farmer from Iowa. I currently live here in Minnesota, but I go back and forth and do the farming. So I'm a sixth generation farmer. Farm was established in 1864. We've been farming it now 161 years. And we grow corn and soybeans over 200 acres. We have nothing but John Deere. My father was the first black John Deere. My father was the first black supervisor and engineer at John Deere in 1968 during the race riots in Waterloo, Iowa. Mm-hmm. And so we have a farm. We have two farms, one farm in Waterloo, one farm in New Sharon. And during those race riots we had in Waterloo, he was the first Black supervisor to come out of that, much like a lot of opportunities came out of the George Floyd situation. So he became the first Black supervisor. And so everything was going well. And like him, he had 18 jobs too, one of which was running Chicago Marathon in addition to farming and watching my mom sing opera in New York and all this good stuff. And so he would run, he would do his work until about 9 p.m. at night, and he'd go to the track and run around the track and train. And he did that for 13 marathons. And on the 13th marathon, which is how I got here, I want to give the context, how I got to Iowa Farmers of Colors, that 2008, he went out as usual at 9 o'clock to run a track. At 1 o'clock in the morning, he was nowhere to be found. We got that dreaded call at the dreaded knock at the door at 7 a.m. that my father had was killed in a bicycle accident. So 2008 changed my life forever. And so at that point, me being the oldest, boom, here you go. Here's the farm. And so, you know, I was supposed to come back to later on. And so me, my mom, my brother, my son, we banded together and we've been farming ever since. We've actually, my mom came out of retirement and she had just completed her doctorate degree. And so she was in retirement. And so she comes out, she gets us, you know, strong Black woman. She gets us.
And she was an opera singer, right? Opera singer?
Yeah, she's an opera singer. She's a Black woman from Chicago and knows nothing about agriculture. She was the first Black supervisor. She's the first Black cheerleader at Proviso East in Chicago and Maywood. And so she comes out of retirement and I always say she's 5'4", but she walks 8 foot tall. And so she, you know, she was able to command presence and they put their arms, the state agencies put their arms around her and helped her walk through different things. So she handled the program business side. Me and my brother handled the mechanical farming and I handled the visionary of where we wanted to be. So then fast forward till today, going through that experience, I thought to myself, you know, I started learning the history of our farm and realized we're 161 years old. Like, and I started telling my story, and which then gets me to this point. And I said, well, there's gotta be other people that might be going through this or might wanna know about farming. So that's why me and a small group of people started the Iowa Farmers of Color back right before COVID. And it just consisted of, just like we are right now on a call, we say, hey, so what are you growing? Oh, I'm growing this. And it was really small. And then I said, no, we gotta make this bigger, right? So then fast forward, here we are with an official logo, official name. We have our third annual conference coming up on December 5th and 6th. And what it does is it aims to, number one, build community amongst all farmers, but specifically farmers of color. Number two, build that information, bridge that information gap between farmers and state agencies, because as we know, that information doesn't always trickle down to us. And I always say, I'm stop saying the word trickle down because we're not down here, spread out. It doesn't trickle out to us, right? Mm-hmm. We're farmers just like everybody else. And right. So the information doesn't trickle out. And thirdly, is ultimately to how can we save money, right? How can we learn about different programs, save money? And then the other thing is making talking about legacy. How do we protect our legacy? Because like all of us probably on this call, our family somewhere has a farm somewhere in Mississippi, Alabama, whatever, that may have been lost because there's no plan putting together to pass that on. So we make sure that every conference we talk about, you can have it, but is it in writing? Is it in paper? Did you put it together officially? And so we really make sure that, because there's so many stories of Black farmers losing their farm because granddaddy never put it in writing. So now he's got 12 kids and they got 12 different ideas what to do with it. So at any rate, so our conference is, our third annual conference is December 5th. The social night, December 5th, we're gonna be showing the film Farming While Black. December 6th is the actual conference. During that conference, we're gonna talk about how to, it's for beginning farmers, regular farmers, urban farmers, and row crop farmers like myself. And some of our courses are gonna be, if you're new or thinking about farming, how do you start a farm? And then more importantly, how do you use AI to help you start that farm? And then the other thing is talking about, you know, how do you create a succession plan to keep your farm? And then how to set up your farm, whether it's LLC, whether it's S Corp, how do you do these types of things? Because so many farms are lost because of that. So that's when the conference is. And even though it says Iowa Farms of Color, we try to incorporate the Midwest, but we started Iowa because obviously I'm from Iowa. And so we have many members, part of the Iowa Farms of Color here in Minnesota. Some of which you might know is Lori James from Solid Roots. And what she does is she puts together women coming out of incarceration, bonds them together with the children through agriculture. So right now, so we get 20 to 30 acres, build an infrastructure on 20, 30 acres, and using the farm and agriculture as a way to bond them together. The other person we have is Chantel Smith from the Crew Urban Youth Equestrians. We use youth experience for healing and growth through horses, using equestrian for the kids. And then Route One with Marcus Carpenter, he's going to talk about his. And then Millicent Cassell, she has Mama's Honey House, and she's a beekeeper, and she uses up in Stanton, and she does transformative power of fungi and ancestral plant traditions. And so we have a myriad and variety of different types of farmers. It's not your traditional farms that you think of, like myself. But so in a nutshell, that's what our Farms of Color is. And then I'd like to introduce you to Marcus Carpenter, who takes farming. Oh, and I forgot my son, Todd the Fourth. Todd the Fourth with Freedom Farms. He grows microgreens. He grows microgreens, and he recognized the food desert in North Minneapolis. So he grows microgreens and supplies restaurants downtown with microgreens. And he incorporates youth in helping build that program. And then Marcus Carpenter was Route One, and I'll let him introduce himself.
Hey, Marcus.
Hey, Al. And thank you, Todd. Thank you, Mr. Kelly. It is so great to be here. Now, first of all, I just want to say how much I appreciate the opportunity to be here in your presence, Al. You are a major force and one of the originators in the media industry, specifically for our community, not only here in Minnesota, but across the country. So it is truly an honor to be here with you. But yeah, thank you, Todd, for the invite. You know, Route One, what we do at Route One is we work to increase food access, and that's specifically within underserved communities. And the way that we do that is we support our local farmers who are growing food in those communities. And the reason why we do that, the reason why we're supporting those local farmers, those local producers, is because we believe that if we can help these farmers not only grow a good tomato, but if we can help them grow their business, we can increase food access, we can increase economic development, we can increase health equity, we can increase career and leadership development by teaching our young people how to farm and how to get their hands in the dirt. And then on the flip side of that, we can also decrease the instances of sugar diabetes, of heart disease and chronic disease that are affecting our communities. And so that's what we do here at Route One. Very briefly, I'll give you the history of our family. Much like Todd, I'm a fourth generation farm kid. So my family hails from Tyronza, Arkansas, Northeast Arkansas, about 45 minutes northwest of Memphis. And so back in 1914, my great grandparents bought their first 20 acres of farmland, and they grew that farm to 180 acres by the time my great grandfather passed in 1936. And my great grandmother, who was just an angel, never got a chance to meet her, but she had 18 children, all natural, 18 children. And my grandfather was fourth from the bottom. And so they raised all of those children on 1/2 mile country road. And so if you think about what these country roads look like in the Deep South, at the end of that country road, there was a family cemetery that to this day houses about 60 of our ancestors. There used to be a church before it was burnt down during the civil rights era. But the name of that old country road is called Route One. And so when we decided to name our organization and what we were going to do, we named it Route One because it has a special place in our heart. Route One for me and our family was the place where I got together with my cousins. You know, we all traveled to the South during school breaks and summer breaks, and we did what farm kids do. You know, we skipped rocks, we shot BB guns, we rode three-wheelers. And so, but most importantly, what we did was we got our hands in the dirt. And we listened to our aunts and our uncles, and we listened to the opportunity to learn about where our food came from and the stories of our ancestors. And so what we truly believe is that if we can continue to get our young people together, to get the folks within our community together, what we can do is we can, you know, we can bring forth some of those lessons from Route One, right? Those lessons of hard work, integrity, you know, of love. But most importantly, and I'm sure Ken can relate to this, is how do we grow a profitable farm business? And so that's what we focus on at Route One, is we bring the stories of the farm, outdoor farming, conservation, soil health, but we also bring the stories of indoor farming. So we're here in the upper Midwest. And so, you know, people can't just have good food 6 months out of the year. So we have our shipping container farm that allows us to go premium produce. We market that produce in 5 different markets. We are fortunate enough to be partnered with folks like Gavin Kaysen, who is a James Beard award-winning chef, and also with Andrew Zimmern and some of our big premium chefs here in the upper Midwest to be able to not only grow good food for our communities, but we're also creating business models that give an opportunity for our young people.
With issues here. So listeners, if you hear some chopping, it's a internet bandwidth, but go ahead, Marcus, go ahead.
Oh, sorry about that. Sorry if I'm cutting out, but just wanted to end on, you know, we're given the opportunity for our young people to not only learn about farming, our communities to learn about farming, but to also build a profitable business model.
And so what's the national landscape like for farmers in general? I think farmers are crying foul right now because their markets are destabilized by.
You know, I'll speak on behalf of the small. I'm sorry. Go ahead, Al.
Go ahead.
I was going to say, I'll speak on behalf of the small farmers and I'll turn it over to Tad. Maybe he can speak more to the row crop farmers. You know, from a local small farming perspective, you know, before we talk about who's producing and who's growing, first, it's important to talk about hunger relief, right? And so we are facing a time in our nation's history where, you know, being able to feed our communities is of the utmost importance. You know, here in the state of Minnesota, there's 1 out of 10 Minnesotans that are facing food insecurity. 1 out of 7 of those are children. If you're Black, Brown, and Indigenous, you have a 25% chance to be more likely to be food insecure than the regular population. And thus far in 2025, we've already experienced over 9 million food shelf visits. And so what that means, Al, is that we have to do a better job of getting more food into our communities. And so the work that Todd and I and some of the other amazing organizations here in the Twin Cities are doing is of the utmost importance. And so the average farmer in the state of Minnesota only earns, the small farmer, right, 10 acres or less, they earn less than $25,000 per year. Mm-hmm. And so what we're doing at Route One is we're creating a model that can allow farmers to generate over $300,000 in revenue, but also be able to bring home a profit of close to $200,000. So if you're doing the math, that's a 33% margin within our farm business. And so that's what we're talking to our capital partners about, is really how do we create these amazing agricultural businesses right in our communities. We've built the platform, and so we're excited actually about where local ag is going and local food is going because of the challenges that exist. We feel like we're going to be able to solve
it. And when you say local ag, are you talking about in the county or even in the city or in the state? What does local ag mean to you? And the reason I ask is you know, if your son, Todd the Fourth, is doing microgreens, is he doing that right in North Minneapolis or is he out in Champlain or one of the-
No, he's doing it right in North Minneapolis.
That's the point, yeah. So where we are is a place that an investment can make sense, right?
Absolutely.
Absolutely. Yeah. I'll say this briefly and I'll pass it over to Todd. But, you know, with we call it the Agriculture Conservation Micro Campus. It's a 12,000 square foot property. And so Al, so the first one is in Minnetonka. We've just, for those who don't know, it's a ring suburb of here of the Twin Cities. We just purchased our second location in St. Paul, which is about 5 miles north of the capital. And then we are looking for locations 3 through 5. But to your point, Al, the locality and the locality of food can be a local community. It can also be in rural areas, but also be within those local communities. So it's really I think what we make of it. And when we think about non-local food or big food, what we think about is food that comes in off of a truck, right? Mm-hmm. And so that's how we make the distinction at Route One. It's all important, but where we focus our effort is how do we continue to focus on growing more farmers in addition to growing more food.
So Al, yeah, can so, let me jump in just because sure. It's just a little bit of serendipity here. Week before last, I was speaking to roughly 1,000 agriculture bankers from the stage there in St. Louis, Missouri. And to hear Marcus talk about, you know, the banking aspect of it is just one of those things that I'm saying is serendipity that we are here together today. And so let's be sure we connect because I while we do not do ag lending, I certainly can be helpful to you and hopefully getting you to and in front of some bankers who do that and understand it. And so I'd love to be sure that we do that. The second thing I want to point out back to serendipity is that I believe it was Todd made reference to passing. When I talked about the book that I wrote, it was about ensuring that African-Americans can pass their property in a way that matters, that's impactful. In fact, we lose a tremendous amount of wealth because we don't. In fact, only 3 in 10 Blacks even have a will. That doesn't get into trust or anything others even more sophisticated. So many of us have, let's call it air property on, I got it on both sides of my family. I raised both hands. But the point I'm making is that these are challenges that we are facing as a community together, and we have to figure out how to solve these problems within our communities in a way that we can all be prosperous. So I just wanted to interject that, Al. Thank you.
Well, I wanted you also, I was going to come back to you before we closed, Chairman Kelly, just to connect you with your farm story. And I don't know if you mentioned, you know, what's your family's roots? Because all of us have a farm background, as Marcus said. Is your family connected to farming in some way?
That was probably not by choice.
Not by choice. For all
so,
of us.
Ironically, the ancestor that I know, you know, the oldest ancestor I know, ironically, was brought from South Carolina to Alabama by a Scottish banker. Hmm. His name was Oliver McNabb, and he's the oldest we've been able to trace back in roots. And this is the early 1800s. And so I've got 5 generations buried in Barber County, Alabama, that basically most of them farm all the way up through, I would say, my parents. So my grandparents had a farm, and, you know, we still have that farm. There's not a lot of direct farming, like plants, grow crops on it anymore. But yeah, we still have a farm in the family. So yes, that's this something I know well. I have been down in a well to clean it out. So something that I think about recently, because it's not, I don't have that level of courage anymore. My wisdom has grown beyond my courage at this point, in this stage of my life. But the point is, yes, we do have farming in our family, Al, and it's something we certainly can relate to. And I'd love to be helpful to Todd and Marcus as much as I can, wherever I can.
Yeah. Well, I love this conversation because Marcus and Todd, you're telling us that farming is now. It's not something that's tucked away in the back of our minds, our histories, but we've got a place and an opportunity to understand the agricultural world and our place in it and how it can benefit us and benefit community and society. I want to pull up a picture here like that you all will like as well. Jared put it up. This is, I'll describe it for our listening audience, people on KFAI, but it's a picture of the cover of this week's Insight News, and the title is It's Hog Killing Time. And this is a Thanksgiving story written by a photojournalist out of California who writes for Insight from time to time, Brother Haywood Galbraith. But it's a beautiful picture, and I chose to use it on the cover of Insight News, this being Thanksgiving week coming up this week. And he is remembering back in the old days, going to grandma's or grandpa's farm and farm community. So I wanted to share that with you guys and in a sense, close the program on responding or reflecting on this legacy of farming and of feeding ourselves. So we're part of it. But Todd, you can take it down now. I want you to see it. Todd, come back in and you can respond to the questions that Mark has started and others that you may have as well.
Oh, yeah. So again, you know, it's you. The last question you asked was about the tariffs. You know, the tariffs are significant, significant to everyone. You know, it's, you know, $23 billion is lost because we were exporting to China. And, you know, this year we just got done combining our soybeans and we were down, our yield was down 5%, but our pricing was down almost 40% versus 2023 when we did soybeans at 23, you know, they're down almost 40%, right? And so now, but then you add that onto, I got less for what I did bring in, right? Mm-hmm. And on top of that, I got 5% less. On top of that, my chemical costs were even more higher. And fortunately for us, we don't have, sorry, Chairman Kelly, we don't have any bank loans with any banks. So we're everything's paid for.
I get it. And that's as you grow, though, you know, leverage and debt is not a bad thing. It right, allows you to grow faster than having to use your equity. So I fully understand, understand.
Yeah. But yeah, so it's, but again, that's what the Iowa Farms of Color is to put that together, is to give this type of information. And I invite anybody from Minnesota and surrounding states to please come and attend. I know if anybody's ever, please look up this film called Farming While Black, because the big trend now is young millennials that are, you know, this, in this particular case, this woman works in New York and she says, you know what, I'm done with it. I'm gonna buy a farm upstate New York. She bought 40 acres. They did a documentary film on it. It's a beautiful film. So I'd encourage everybody to come to Ames, Iowa by Iowa State, and come December 5th and 6th and partake in our conference. Everybody's invited, and we do have a strong Minnesota contingency that will be down there.
Awesome. We're down to the last couple of minutes. I want to take one more round here and just ask each of you to whatever reflection, advice, direction, based on this conversation, the things you're dealing with, touching in your daily life, you'd like to share with our listeners and our viewers. Chairman Kelly, let me start with you.
I feel enthused. I'm proud to see Todd and Marcus doing what they're doing. I just love honey baked ham. And I would tell you, I thought about just starting a hog farm by myself because of the price that I paid for that ham. So I'm inspired by you guys. Let's stay connected. Thank you, Al, for your serendipity in putting us together today.
And Todd, let me go to you next. I'm going to have you wrap us up, Marcus.
Again, I'm only here because I just told my story. So I encourage everybody that's listening. You all have a story to tell. Tell your story with no true real outcomes expected, but just tell your story. And this is how I wound up here, honoring my ancestors. And it's all about the baton. Everything's a race, right? Meaning the baton was handed to me. I'm doing my best to honor my ancestors, to grow the farm, to tell others, and to let other people of color know, like, farming is cool. In my day, I'm 59. In my day, farming wasn't cool, but it's cool again. Again, I invite everybody to go to iowafarmersofcolor.com, attend the conference, and just let's build this community even bigger.
Marcus got about 45 seconds.
Yeah, you got it. Well, thank you so much. I would just echo what these gentlemen said. I am really hopeful about our future. You know, the one thing I would say is that for the listeners that are listening, specifically those that are Black, Brown, and Indigenous, you know, our ancestors literally had the opportunity, not by choice, but we built the strongest free market economy to ever exist on the planet. All that was built right here in the United States with our blood, sweat, and tears. And so that's something when Todd talks about legacy, when Ken talks about legacy, that's something that we can be very proud of. And I think when we think about the farm, you know, we're not necessarily trying to make these young people farmers, but we are trying to help them identify what their future could be.
We got to stop it right there. Gentlemen, thank you so much. We'll see you next time. I'm Al McFarland. This is The Conversation with Al McFarland. Take care.